If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
When you see somebody's number being called before he was ready, somebody who loved life so much, you say to yourself, do you know what? One of the things the nurses in the clinic said at the time, you know, Brendan Grace has taught me something about dying. You know, taught me something about living and dying.
Our guest this week recently described grief as the companion you never wanted. And that's something that myself, Venetia, and many of our listeners know all too well. Amanda Grace is the daughter of Brendan Grace, one of Ireland's all-time legendary figures in comedy and entertainment, whose death in July 2019 saw a special public outcry of grief and love in a way that very few people garner in their life. And it's so wonderful to have you here today to talk to us, Amanda, about your dad. And I have to say, my parents were huge fans, and I think that they would be absolutely amazed that you and I were chatting today. Thank you so much for coming on to talk about your dad. It hasn't been that long since he passed, so I really appreciate you taking the time to talk about grief in the place that you're in right now. First of all, just tell us who he was. I mean, as his daughter, that's a very different thing than what the public might have known.
Yes. Thank you, Sasha, and it's a pleasure to be here. So I'm just going to pick a photograph down off the board in front of me of my dad to answer that question. Who was he? He was a divil, and he was a lot of fun. He was kind of like one of the kids at home. So my mom had five kids.
Wow.
And one of them was the daddy. But he was very mischievous, very clever, very fun. Very warm, really had a way of drawing people in and making people feel like they mattered. He was kind of, you know, he was the king of the workaround. He wasn't great at, you know, like following the rules or something like that. You know, he kind of found his own way about things. And obviously he was funny, you know. He wasn't funny at home the way he was funny on the stage, let's say.
Well, that's a very different, like, it's not as performative, right? I mean, it's performative in a way, but there's an intimacy in that home relationship and the comedy that takes place sort of in within your family.
Yeah.
It's a totally different thing.
Very different. And it's humor, you know?
Yeah.
And that humor is a big feature of our family and always has been, as far back as I can remember. His mother had it, his sister. It was a kind of like a survival humor, but it was a great humor. It really was. The ability to laugh at yourself is something that not everybody possesses. You know?
Mm. And has that, I don't want to skip ahead here, but has that helped you throughout your life to cope as well? Because I know for me, the most cathartic moments, like amidst the darkest moments, has been that memory of the inappropriate laughing. I mean, it does something to you.
Yeah. And it's a way of connecting, I think, with people as well, especially if it's a, you know, if it's a shared, what my dad was great at was like, everybody was in on the joke, you know. He didn't do the kind of comedy that somebody took the brunt of the laugh, you know. Nobody was ever the butt of the joke, and sometimes he was, but, you know. So, yeah, I think it fosters connection between people to have something to laugh about, you know, and to not take life so seriously without being reckless, you know.
You're the eldest, aren't you?
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's a huge relationship in itself, in that you're the first kid to show up on the scene in his life.
Yeah.
As a parent myself, I can imagine it meant more to him than anything in the whole world, because you changed his whole world from the minute you arrive on the scene.
Yeah.
What was it like kind of being the oldest sibling in the family, and how did you and him kind of interact with each other?
I guess being the oldest, there was a lot of permission to be a little bit cheeky and irreverent and to question authority. There wasn't pressures put on me in terms of you're the oldest now, you should be leading by example. There was none of that kind of stuff. When I look back, there are things that because I got 10 years more with my father than my youngest sibling, let's say.
Yeah.
And so I have memories such as, going into the recording studio with him when I was small on the back of his bike with my little lunchbox packed. And I'd be sitting there in the studio, not realizing, that the musicians that are around is like Eamon Campbell and it's all going on. It was all very exciting. And there was a lot of backstage stuff and the smell of makeup and Panto, makeup and crisps. That's like the smell of Panto. Yeah. And, so I loved to go places with him. And I loved as well, I always loved that I was with the star, that he was mine, Now, you'd get trampled on every now and again, back in the 80s, he used to get mobbed a lot. I got trampled on a few times and separated from him a few times. And that was scary. But he was always very proud of me and brought me places where you probably wouldn't bring children. I don't know many artists who would bring a child into a recording studio,
It's very special that he brought you along for it, because I mean, it makes your life unlike anybody else's. It's a very unusual and privileged, amazing place to be. Did you ever resent it? Was there ever times it was hard?
There was times it was embarrassing, like in your teenage years where it's like it was embarrassing to always kind of have a thing that singled me out, so I'd get, I used to pretend my name was other surnames, like my friends that I grow up with. I'd be like, can we swap names and will you be the Grace today? Because I hated when it was when I was identified and then there'd be a bit of like somebody would change towards you. Suddenly they'd be more interested in you because of that. And that for a while, I had to navigate that in my teenage years because, of course, I wanted to be known by my own merit. And that professionally as well, like that has been something that I have had to navigate. But anybody who is quote unquote in the shadow of a larger than life figure has to navigate that. And it really does grow you in a way that I was very, very motivated to find out, well, who am I by my own merit,
Which is an exercise in that not all people do, right? It's kind of that self-discovery and pushing yourself a little bit further. And in Ireland, especially, someone being famous, it's quite overwhelming because it kind of is in every part of life. So everyone knew who he was. And imagine when you were going to college or going to work or going to school, or it's always, everyone knew him. It's not like maybe in how vast America is or something like that, where you could find places in the world where people didn't. Everyone knew him. So it must have been quite a challenge to find your own kind of space within that.
Yes. Yeah. There wasn't any.
Yeah. In terms of like when he got sick and how that happened for you guys, he was a young man. He was not an old man, and he was someone who had probably, you probably had hoped had a lot of life left. So can you talk a little bit about what that experience was like for a lot of people? I know for me, and I just, I relate my own experience here only to for our listeners to feel as though we understand what they've been through is, for me, it was the biggest possible thing that could have happened, hearing the word cancer and the things that happened consequently after that. What was that like for you guys as a family to find out that he wasn't well?
He was battling for a while some health issues, so we had kind of gotten used to his health being fragile. And I know that the last 10 years of his life, I was holding my breath. I don't think I was alone in that. I was constantly waiting for a call, because he had a lot of complications that he took like on the chin, with a pinch of salt. And he's just like, he navigated them Of course, with the support of my mother, but we definitely did, and I personally did, worry all the time about losing my dad to something diabetic related. So in the final year, there had been recurrent chest infections, let's say, is what we believed them to be, and then pneumonia. You know, it kind of was advancing to pneumonia. So there was a couple of hospital admissions, and this pneumonia wasn't going away. And it was quite frightening in that it kept coming back. But nobody thought cancer. Not one of us thought cancer. And I was in the room with him the day he got the news. Himself, me and my mother. And I had driven from Sligo to Galway to be with them to get the news, because I had just arrived back from America. I had done a tour of Oregon. You know, I'd done some workshops when I was over there. And when I came home, he had had a biopsy. And so I flew in on Friday and he was getting the results on Saturday. So I was there on the Saturday for it. And I had a bad feeling, you know, that kind of way, but you'd always have that. But he got the news on the Saturday. And I remember I was sitting behind him and he was sitting on the bed in front of me with his back to me facing the doctor. And when the doctor delivered the news, I just seen his two hands going up over his head like that. And he threw his head back and he went, "Oh, Lord Jesus," kind of a thing, you know. And I was sitting beside a nurse, a complete stranger, and I just grabbed her hand. And there was this moment of, you know yourself, it's just like the bell rings that can't be unrung, kind of a thing. And then the scrambling to cling to the words of the doctor, you know, cling to, where's the hope? Is there, what's he saying? So the doctor was saying, you know, "We don't know. We have found a cancer," is what he said, "from the lung tissue. We don't know too much yet. You know, there are possibilities. There are a lot of treatment options." So he filled us with hope in that moment, because all he knew at that stage, the doctor, was that there is cancer. We don't know anything about the cancer. And so we all naively went into, okay, well, this is good. They found it and it's early. And we went through all of that and scrambling, kind of a thing. You know, you go into that. It's almost like a shock absorbing mode.
Yeah.
Where it's like, okay, let's find the hope in cancer. You know, and it's amazing how fast that can happen, because, you know, on Friday, cancer would have been the worst news.
Yeah.
On Saturday, inoperable would have been the worst news. So how it advances to that, and that's not the news we got initially. So we now call that the fluffy diagnosis, because that was the diagnosis that was like, hey, look, this is probably operable, definitely treatable. So let's just do a few more tests and see where it goes. But, you know, you've got good healthcare. We can do this.
Okay.
And then it just kind of, you know, it was another couple of days before the real news came, which was on the Tuesday. But I spent from that Saturday, I drove back to Sligo on that night. My mother stayed in Galway with my dad. And I drove home that night and I started to pack bags and I started to cry, and I didn't stop crying until the Tuesday when I arrived back into the room and I literally, you know, composed myself before walking in the door. And I had a very strange experience on the way down in the car, because I literally cried my way with my, you know, white knuckling it on the steering wheel, cried my way, you know, from Galway, or from Sligo to Galway, which is a good 2.5 hours of a drive for me. But like, I was in the car crying, and I think I must have been praying as well. I'm not sure. But I was doing the, oh, please God thing. And the next thing, my car just filled up with an energy. And suddenly I felt like the car was full and that I had 3 passengers with me in the car. It was the weirdest thing. And it continued. They stayed with me all the way to the hospital. And so when I arrived into the room, and I had a moment with my parents just before the consultant arrived in, I said to them, I said, "Listen, whatever news we get now, whatever happens," I said, "I know that we're being held." And I told them what happened in the car. I said, we're not alone in this. But I also knew, because of that experience, that it was what was coming.
So the spiritual experience that was happening also told you that, you know, this
yes.
this isn't, you're going to need us. Like, you're going to,
that's
you're
it.
Gonna, yeah, yeah.
I don't know if you experienced it yourself, Sasha, but there's a quality of the heavens open when death comes to your door. What it really is your heart is opening. And it, you know, and what made it through to me, because I have a spirituality that I do nourish and nurture, and the heavens opened for me and for my family, and we all felt held in those days.
I think it's I was the one of the questions last night, I was lying in bed and I was thinking about what I wanted to ask you, what I wanted to talk to you about. And one of the questions I, for some reason with you, and I wouldn't always necessarily feel comfortable asking, but one of the questions I really felt compelled to ask you was, how has grief changed you? And I think in some ways you're answering that, because the similar to me, there's like a cracking open, there was for me anyway, where the world was not the same as it had been prior to, you know, that moment of hearing, you know, it's inoperable or the person's not going to live. And suddenly something changes so big in your head and your heart and your life. I know when I had my daughter, my parents had both passed at that point, and I felt very alone when I went into the theater to have my surgery, and it was an emergency C-section, and they've kind of strapped, my husband was waiting in the hall, but there was something just, I craved my family, my parents, my sister, and they kind of put me down on the table, and for some reason I just immediately could feel them there.
Yeah.
My dad at one side, my mom at the other side, my sister, and it was, and I, you know, I'd never experienced anything like that before, and it's not something I experience every day by any means, but it was an overwhelming thing of that they were, you know, that there was more and that things were changing in terms of how you see the world and how you experience things. How did your dad and your mom react to you saying that? Like, was that something that they were also like accepting of, and did it help comfort them?
Yeah, I just want to say before I answer that, I have to share this line, this beautiful line from a Paul Simon song. It's from Graceland.
Oh, I know the one you're going to say. Good.
Losing love is like a window in your heart. Everyone can see you're blown apart. It's not true that everyone can see that you're blown apart. Unfortunately, it's not.
That line in that song has always, so it actually didn't really mean that much to me until after I had experienced grief. And then I agree with you completely. It so perfectly captures it.
It does.
Because you are blown. There's you're blown open in that way.
Yeah.
You know, I always think about the responsibility of being a person in that room.
Yeah.
When you're with someone who is being told that they're not gonna live.
Yeah.
And you love that person immensely.
Yes.
And it's a huge responsibility to sit there and to carry that weight. Did you feel, I mean, how did that, were you honored to be able to help him through this process?
Yeah. I am so grateful that I was there, because I very much felt that I absorbed some of the shock, you know, just my physical presence and the holding presence that I have. You know, it's what I do professionally is, you know, this kind of real sharing intimate space with people, you know, so I know how to be a holder of space. You know, you have to brace yourself a little bit, you know, so I'm thinking to myself, do I say this? Do I not say this? Because you don't want to spook anybody either. You know, the way you, and this is the big thing about grief. People are like, and depression and everything, like if I speak it, I'll make the person cry, you know, I'll make it real, and then it'll be too overwhelming. So I remember sitting, because I was sitting there for a while with the question in my mind of how am I going to deliver this? But I also knew that I needed to say it before the doctor came in. I needed for this to be, and I remember sitting, they were sitting on the windowsill bench in the hospital room, and I was sitting on a chair in front of them, and I said to them, I said, you know, I just said, listen, here's, I don't even know how I pronounce it, but I just put it out there, and I said, whatever we hear now, whatever happens next, I have full faith and I know that we're being held. And it was just a lovely moment between the three of them. But my father was also very, and my mother, we've always been, without being, you know, kind of like we've a very subtle spirituality in the home that is very much part of the natural fabric of our lives. So it is expressed in you know, like memory, really. There's a lot of remembering people who have gone has always been a thing that happens in our family. Songs, you know, photographs, and also my dad had, you know, the robin. Every house has a robin that comes to visit, you know, and my dad loved that robin. Like he used to feed the robin because the robin represented his mother to him and the spirit world. And he just always had that. And we have it now, you know, like we have been finding ways to accommodate my dad in this house since he has gone.
Oh, that's such a beautiful thing to hear you say, because the relationship with the person when they're gone, it's a very complicated thing for people, especially who have never lost someone, to hear that the relationship goes on, it just goes on in lots of different ways. Yes, of course, there's days where it feels like they're gone forever and you can't connect and you wish they were still here. Of course, you'd always wish that. But if you could tell me a little bit about how you guys do that, because I think it can be a very powerful thing when you still include them in your world.
Yeah. Okay. Well, for a start, he's right here, right beside me. So I have a little urn. Each of the siblings, we all received a little urn, and we have a big urn. So we call it Big Dad is upstairs, and we all have little dads. And, you know, again, with the humor, my dad in the 80s had a song, he parodied a song by the Wolf Tones, My Heart is in Ireland. But his parody was, my heart is in Ireland, my lungs are in New York, my liver's in Liverpool, my brains are in Bangkok, or something like that. And on the day that we picked up his ashes, the undertaker came out and he was handing me the big urn. And he was like, it's a bit heavy now, so just, you know, brace yourself. So I took it and I was like, and again, humor, but it was just the weirdest thing. And I said to him, my God, that was heavy. And he said, yeah, and it's like really full. And we just had a good laugh about it because, you know, there was like, there was a really big urn that was really, really full. And then there was four small urns that were really, really full. And we were just like, this is Dad all over. Like just filling whatever space he inhabited, he took it up. As in life, so in death kind of thing. And then also we thought about the song. And would you believe it came on the radio as we were leaving the funeral home that day. It was, yeah, it was the weirdest thing. And we all had a good laugh going home with his ashes.
But how did you guys, I mean, in terms of the way the public obviously were so moved and miss him so much and felt the loss, was that a hard thing for you, or was it a beautiful thing to see so many people? Because you're talking, you know, in those days especially, I can't imagine what it feels like. It's so much pressure, and it's really hard to go through that process of a wake and a funeral. But when you've got so many people around the world feeling it too, how was that?
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
It was exactly as it should have been. So my dad, when he was planning his funeral, he, you know, was saying, I'm going to go here. And what he said was, as my coffin is going into the church, I want everybody to sing Dublin in the Rare Old Times. And we're kind of looking at each other going, do you want us to start singing? Do we hire, like, how... We're asking, like, what's the logistics of that? How do we get that going? How do we get a sing song going at that stage? Like, and he said, oh, no, he said the people will sing that. we were just like, oh, okay. And I wrote down all the notes. I still have all the notes of all his requests. And as we approached the church, that's exactly what happened. My dad knew his people. He knew his audience so well. He knew his fans so well. He loved them and they loved him. And it was like they gave him, and of course, being in the Liberties where he belonged, so he was going home and they knew exactly what to do. And, do you know, there's a thing about speaking, you know, speak it, name it, name the thing that you want and watch it come to you, kind of a thing, you know, not always, you know, I know there's an awful lot to consider there, but that is what happened. He envisioned a funeral that he wasn't going to witness himself in as, you know, in his embodied self, but he actually envisioned the funeral he got. It was exactly the funeral he envisioned, and it was such a gift. It was a gift to be held like that by people. It was a gift to, you know, have the area around us come to a standstill and everybody join us in our grief and witness our grief and cry for us and pray for us. It's something that I wish everybody could have. And we're good at it in Ireland, as in bringing it to, you know, bringing the town to a standstill to respect the funeral cortege, and people are good with that. But in our case, it continued way beyond that weekend, let's say, in the week of the funeral. It was, you know, it was ongoing. It even got interrupted by the pandemic. There was things planned that didn't happen, but there was a documentary, there was a show, there was numerous accolades and interviews and things that just, you know, so that was really helpful, because one of the things I think that is most difficult in grief is the navigating it in a world that doesn't know it happened, you know, and that doesn't stop for you and that just keeps going as normal. And, you know, there's nothing more heartbreaking to a grieving person than, you know, the world and people in it just expecting you to be as you were.
Yeah.
And being shitty with you for not being that way, you know?
Yeah, I mean, that is, I think that's the most difficult surprise, I think, when people, they expect that maybe people will still understand and be loving and caring. They're shocked to find how callous, and that's true. People can, they wish that you could move on. I want to ask you a question about something, because I want to learn more about it. And I have a feeling, you know, you've mentioned it a couple of times. So I have a feeling you know something about this. The term holding space and the idea of holding space, because of exactly what we're talking about right now, which is how people respond to grief and how people support each other. Supporting each other through grief, through supporting someone through grief is very difficult, especially if you've never experience grief yourself. But holding space, can you talk a little bit about what that means to you and how that can be useful? Because I think it can be extremely useful in caring for someone in your life who has been through a loss.
So what holding space means, and do you have show notes, Sasha?
Yeah.
Okay, well, I'll send you an article to put in the show notes, and it is an article about, it's literally how to hold space for somebody. Mm-hmm. And it is such, everybody should read this article. So the metaphor that it takes is dropping a pebble into a body of water. And the point of impact is the point at which the person is bereaved, you know? So whoever it is that is bereaved by this is the point of impact of the pebble. And then the rippling outwards are the concentric circles of support around that person. Mm-hmm. And so whoever is first in line is absorbing the most shock and as it goes outwards. But the flow of energy is very important to know. So the flow of energy has to go outwards. So if you don't lean in, you lean out.
Okay.
Right? So you never lean on the bereaved person to do the, you know, to hold you. You only lean back, like who's got my back and who's got her back. And so there's this idea for a start that is the hierarchy, let's say, of support. Okay. Mm-hmm. So you only lean out and not in. And then secondly, what holding space means is just to allow it be in the room as it is, to allow for it to look how it is, sound how it is, you know, becoming up as it is, and also to allow for the ugly part of it. You know, the snotty tears, the angry bit where it's not fair, and not trying to bright side it with silver linings, you know. And if, you know, there are two words that I despair to hear coming out of anybody's mouth, and it's, well, at least when I hear a sentence beginning with that, I shut down because I think to myself, no, not at least. I'm not going to look for the bright side here, and go away. So that, but that is a human tendency, because it's very uncomfortable to see somebody else struggling in the mess. So what holding space means is learning how to sit in the mess and the uncomfortable bits, you know?
I'm so glad we're talking about this, because this is something that it's like once you see it, you can't unsee it, right? So once you know about these things and you are aware of them, you're so aware of your own behavior, and you're aware of how you're treating other people, and you're aware of the words that you're using. And for me, I'm so much more cognizant of trying to hold space for people and not trying not to fix. And so not even trying to repair what had happened in my own grief journey, because I, you know, there's a lot of, I couldn't, obviously, but in terms of like how I can help people going forward. Is there, like, when you talk about holding space, I think sometimes I get confused a little bit about the element of just sort of being quiet and listening. But also, are there kind of like strong, is there language that can be powerful that can say to someone, I am here and I'm not going anywhere and I'm also not trying to fix this?
Yeah. I think one of the things that I learned myself is when you're asking somebody, because it feels weird to ask somebody who's grieving, how are you doing? Because it's, you know, like it's a question where you're like, and the receiver is kind of like, well, how do you think I'm doing? I don't know how to answer that. So always put the word today at the end of that question. How are you doing today? How's today been? So it's very much about trying to bring the language into the present moment, I think, and just understanding that, you know, you only have to answer that for this moment. How are you right now? Kind of a thing. And in terms of language, like I said, there's, you know, not to be minimizing with the at least. So that's the kind of the bright side, trying to get the person to cheer up. I think as well that questions have to come from a place of curiosity and not, you know, a kind of an expectation that there will be information dispensed at the end of it, you know. Here's the big thing as well, is to maybe loosen your grip on the need for language at all in these situations. So why does it have to be a conversation? Why does it have to be a phone call? What's, you know, get in your car and come down and go for a walk with me, you know, like just physical presence of being around. Also, hear my no. Really, really hear my no, please. Allow space for me to say, no, not today.
So important, so important. When I was, I think the feeling when I realized how old your dad was, my overwhelming feeling was he was so young, you know. But I, in my head, I was reminded of when my parents died, and people said, "Well, you know, it's not like they were that young." And that's the kind of flipping that people do sometimes to deal with it, you know, and you think, well, they were in their 60s. If you're in your 60s, you know, you still have a lot, you could have a long life ahead of you. And it's about those kinds of at leasts and those, you know, well, at least you had them for this long, or at least they didn't suffer, or at least didn't go on long, or at least they had a wonderful life, or, you know, and those are very, like you said, they're very damaging things, because they're damaging to the relationship you have with that person. Very damaging, very hard to come back from those kinds of statements. I think
the quantifying of grief, right? I've been bereaved before, you know. I've lost a couple of friends, and I've also lost a couple of pregnancies, and I've gotten sober, and I'm recovering from an eating disorder, like, so I'm no stranger to grief. But losing my dad is a different kind of grief. And what I recognized when I, you know, the kind of, it's an education, because I was like, oh, immediately I thought of friends of mine who lost their dad maybe 10 years ago. And I didn't get it.
Yeah,
I absolutely didn't get it. So this quantifying of grief, and then with miscarriage, how far gone were you? So that's like, how old was he?
Yeah.
How far gone were you? And, I learned the hard way not to answer those questions, because I answered it one time about one of my pregnancies, and the answer from a male was, not so bad, so. And I was like, excuse me?
And I mean, miscarriage, we have so much to learn in how to talk about it with people, I think, to the point that it's like, I still can't believe we are where we're at. When I have friends and people in my life who have lost babies, I still hear people saying what you're saying to them. Oh, it was 6 weeks. Oh, well, then it's fine. It's fine. They didn't feel all the excitement. Their body didn't go through all the change. Like, it's bullshit of the highest order that we can't seem to find a way to allow for that to be a real, true, honest, horrid loss.
Yes. I had three losses in that. Like, I had two pregnancy losses, and then I decided to not have children. And that was a loss that wasn't a physical, nothing physically happened in my body, but I closed it down. I closed down the possibility and the potential for that. And so it was a whole life trajectory path that I put up a gate, and I was like, no. And there was grief around that, but completely disenfranchised.
Yeah.
You know?
Did you have people, were there people in your life that you were able to share that with and help you along the way? Or did you feel like it was a solo journey?
I had a lot of support and understanding and patience in my life, but I still did feel like nobody gets it. Nobody really gets what I'm really going through here, because there was so much that was going on at the time. It was what led to sobriety for me. It was a complete and utter midlife crisis because it was an identity, you know, crisis. It was also, it was a prerequisite to a kind of recovery I never thought that I would step into, in terms of how I relate to my physical body, you know, the abuse that I have put my body through over the years, you know, and that came up. Like, I was confronted with that. And I was confronted with the role alcohol was playing, just the way I was throwing myself around the place, like as if I was just this object that, you know, didn't, you know, all of that came up. So when I said no to motherhood, what I was choosing, I was saying yes to recovery. And that was all going on beneath the surface. That's not to say you can't have both motherhood and recovery. I couldn't. In my specific psychological, spiritual mishmash and physiological mishmash, it wasn't to be for me. I chose something else, you know. I chose to express my maternal energy through my work.
Yeah. And I hope I'm asking this question in a way that's respectful. So please tell me if I'm not. But this evolution, right? Like this getting to this sobriety, all of these things, like you, it's very raw and you learn so much. You learn so much about humanity through it. Looking back now, do you feel a sense of freedom that you've chosen to learn so much and to break through that wall of evolution? And it's not an easy journey to get there, to be open, to be that evolved, to kind of get to that much more evolved state. It's a hard place to be, but it's also rewarding in lots of ways.
It is. I'm proud of my choice. I know that it was the right choice for me. It is such a relief to have made the choice, because the agonizing about it was just endless. And in this case, I am, you know, I'm grateful for the, you know, I want to do the my cousin Vinny moment, the biological clock. I'm grateful for the biological clock ticking in my ear, because it kind of felt like I was running out of time to make the choice. And there's nothing like a time deadline to actually get you to move and act and just make a decision. Otherwise, you could sit in indecision for the rest of your life. So I made a call. I made a choice. I've often said it's not a choice that I would have made willingly. So I have to remind myself every day, you chose this, Amanda. On the hard days, this is what you chose. And there's an awful lot of clumsiness in it, an awful lot of awkwardness in it, a lot of collateral damage in it. Like, all the priorities change. You know, there's so much collateral damage that comes with it, because I choose me over things and people that don't like it. You know, and I have this, I have a spiritual guide myself, and I meet her, and, you know, right now that's what we're working on. We're working on the idea that, you know, the confidence to choose whatever I want to call it, choose my recovery, choose me, but choose what matters to me in my life, the courage and conviction to choose those things and let the dice fall where they may around that choice. Let people be disappointed, let down, surprised by all of that thing, because they're the things that keep us in our boxes, like the fear of hurting someone's feelings. And it goes back to like the, whatever, that trite statement, like you can't make an omelette by cracking an egg. But by fuck do I want that omelette, you know? I really, really want it.
I think, you know, from my point of view of listening to hear you speak about this, that's so powerful. It's from hearing it from a woman, because this is against everything that we have been taught.
Yeah.
You know, make yourself small, be accommodating, say yes when you mean no. And to hear you kind of push against that and the rebellion against that and to choose yourself is a remarkably powerful thing, in my opinion. Because I feel like I battle with that conversation in my head every single day. Be likable.
Don't be
ultimately
selfish.
Everyone around me needs to be happy first.
Yeah.
And then I'll somehow deal with myself at some point later, at some point in the day, maybe.
Yeah.
And that day often never comes.
Mm-hmm.
Even in language, in emails, in all these things where we try to be as nice and putting everyone else. It's just, I think it's, I wish we could hear more voices like yours breaking through and expressing, choosing yourself, and the bravery it takes to do that. Because it's not, I'm not in any way saying it's easy. I can't even actually imagine how hard it is to get to the place where you are that amazing of a force.
And you never get there, actually. It's just a practice. And every day you learn, oh, okay, well, you know, I'm still going to choose me, but I might do it a little bit differently the next time, you know, because ouch, you know, and there is a fallout, you know, there is shit to deal with along the way. But again, you have to keep coming back and forgiving. You know, being like, you know, well, that's everything is an opportunity to learn, but nothing is an excuse to stay in your misery, you know, to tolerate your own misery. And that's the raw deal that's been handed to women. It's like, you know, on one hand, teaching us to tolerate our own misery. And then on the other hand, telling us that our misery is our fault and we've to get out, you know, like to do better, do all the things and be perfect while we're doing them. It's ridiculous. But there's a beautiful poem. It's called Love After Love by Derek Walcott. And hopefully it's okay to just mention poems on podcasts. I'll give it to you also for your show notes. But it says is, the time will come when, with elation, you will greet yourself arriving at your own door, in your own mirror, and each will smile at the other's welcome and say, sit here, eat. You will love again the stranger who was yourself. And it talks about this idea of coming home to yourself. You know, this stranger who has loved you all your life, whom you ignored for another, who knows you by heart. And on the very end, it says, sit, feast on your life. And it's still like, I mean, that's an invitation. If that comes in your door, you're like, I want to feast on my life and not be like scrimping around for breadcrumbs for fear of pissing off the person who owns the loaf, you know? Anyway, I've gone off on a total tangent, but this is
great. I mean, I could talk to you forever. I'm really like, I'm so appreciative of you sharing very important and intimate moments in your life with us.
And this is grief too, you know, like when you see somebody's number being called before he was ready, somebody who loved life so much, you say to yourself, do you know what? One of the things the nurses in the clinic said at the time, you know, Brendan Grace has taught me something about dying. You know, so it taught me something about living and dying. And it's like to be able to deal with your own grief, because my dad had to mourn his own life.
Yeah.
You know, and that was so painful to watch. That was probably the hardest thing to watch. And it didn't last long. You know, he just went in there for a day and he had his grief. But he reconciled. He said, you know, I'm happy with how it went. And that's what matters at the end of the day. And that will motivate you. It motivated me as a person to say, you know what? I'm going to choose different. And even if it means getting it wrong sometimes, I'm still on the same. I'm still going to choose this path I'm on, you know?
Well, I can't think of a better way to end it than to have somebody looking back and saying, I'm glad with the way it went. I think that's a pretty incredible thing and a good reminder, as you're saying, to all of us that there will be a moment for every single one of us where we will look back and we will have to make peace with that. So thank you so much for your time. Check out the show notes for everything that we discussed there in the conversation. And yeah, I appreciate it so much.
I appreciate you, Sasha. Thank you so much.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.